Our next speaker, Roland Griffiths from Johns Hopkins, is going to talk about psilocybin occasions, mystical type experiences. If you guys want to try to set up the machine while I'm talking, that's absolutely fine. Excuse me. Psilocybin occasions, mystical type experiences having sustained personal meaning and spiritual significance. The sustained part of it, I believe, comes from the fact that they've just done a 14-month, published a 14-month follow-up study, which shows those results, the initial results, strong. But I'm sure Roland will tell us about that. In his research, most of the volunteers had a complete mystical experience with a high dose of psilocybin. I'm hoping you'll tell us also about how that dose translates chemically into dried grams of mushrooms, which is a street administration, because I think those doses were extremely high, like something like 20 or 30, the equivalent of 20 or 30 dried grams, but I hope you correct me on that. Obviously, I'm very interested in what Roland has to say. As far as formal introduction, Roland Griffiths, R. Griffiths, PhD, is a professor of the departments of psychiatry and neurosciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His principal research focus in both clinical and preclinical laboratories has been on the behavioral and subjective effects of mood-altering drugs. His research has been largely supported by grants from the National Institute on Health, and he is an author of over 300 journal articles and book chapters. He has been a consultant to the National Institutes of Health and to numerous pharmaceutical companies in the development of new psychotropic drugs. He's also currently a member of the Expert Advisory Panel on Drug Dependence for the World Health Organization. He has an interest in meditation and is principal investigator of the psilocybin research initiative at Johns Hopkins. And I will say, just on a personal note about Roland, that he comes to this world, his interest in psychedelics, through his prior interest in meditation, which is an interesting sort of reversal for some of us. So with all of that, I will turn you over to Roland. Thank you very much.
We still have some technical hurdles to conquer, so give us just a second. Can we pull some of the lights off? So I want to thank Kevin and Neil to extending the invitation to me. I'm very pleased to be before you today. And what I'm going to talk about is some of our research on psilocybin occasioning mystical experiences having sustained personal meaning and spiritual significance. Psilocybin, of course, is a naturally occurring tryptamine alkaloid. It's the principal psychoactive component of the psilocybe genus of mushrooms. As you well know, there are 100 species of these mushrooms that contain psilocybin, and they've been used for centuries, if not millennia, within various cultures for sacramental or religious purposes. In terms of historical use, we have these mushroom stone artifacts that are part of the Mayan and Aztec histories, and these date back to 1000 BC. One of these psilocybin mushrooms was called Tina Nanakatel, God's flesh or sacred mushroom in the Aztec language. And then in the 16th century Mexico, the Spanish missionaries were among the first to document the ritualistic use of psilocybin mushrooms. And then subsequent campaigns against what was viewed as this pagan idolatry suppressed these ceremonial use of mushrooms and pushed destroyed the most of the artifacts and the mushroom stones and pushed these ceremonies into secrecy. And so then what I have here is a timeline, a 20th century timeline of work done with psilocybin. So, boy, I regret we can't see this better, but so back in 55, we have Gordon Wasson rediscovering these indigenous mushroom usage in Mexico. 58, Hoffman, the chemist from Sandoz, who had originally synthesized LSD, isolates psilocybin. 59, clinical research with psilocybin is begun, and this is through psilocybin made available from Sandoz. 1960, Leary ingests psilocybin in Mexico. He starts his research at Harvard. 63, he's dismissed from Harvard. 65, arrested for drug possession. 66, coins the phrase, turn on, tune in, drop out. And thereafter, Richard Nixon reportedly calls him the most dangerous man in America. 1962, the Good Friday experiment by Walter Pahnke, whose advisor, in fact, was Timothy Leary. It's a classic study. A number of people have mentioned it, and our work actually plays very importantly off this, and this is showing that psilocybin under appropriate conditions can occasion mystical type experiences. 66 and 68, LSD and psilocybin are banned federally. 67, the psychedelic summer of love in San Francisco, and shortly thereafter, the stigmatization of LSD and psilocybin by the reactionary forces and the ideas that you get chromosome damage and people burning their eyes out, et cetera. 1970, the Controlled Substances Act is passed, and psilocybin and LSD and the other major hallucinogens are put into the most restrictive category. And then, you know, as we all know, research with these compounds went largely dormant. And it was a number of forces coming together that the federal government and the DEA made it very difficult to get the academic research centers, and people within those centers were hesitant to endorse this kind of research. Timothy Leary's work, for all the good that he did, he also really stigmatized a legitimate academic scientific approach to studying these sorts of drugs. Funding dried up, and we stopped doing research. So I think of it as dormant. There was really no, you know, single factor that suppressed it, but a whole series of factors that led to this research stopping. And then, as Dave Nichols has just outlined, Rick Straussman and his DMT work in the early 90s, and then in the late 1990s, we initiated our psilocybin study. Bollinweider started his work in Switzerland, and a group in Germany started up research as well with psilocybin, and we've seen some increase since then. So how did we get into this? So this was back in 1999. We very cautiously initiated a study of psilocybin. At the time, I had a comparative pharmacology grant. I do drug abuse pharmacology at Hopkins. I'm in the departments of psychiatry and neuroscience. And I had a comparative pharmacology grant from the National Institute on Drug Abuse to compare a variety of different drugs, one of which was ketamine, and for a number of reasons we decided we'd switch over and characterize psilocybin instead of ketamine. I was very fortunate in having collaboration from and support from a number of key people in our research team. One was Bob Jesse, who at the time was president of the Council on Spiritual Practices out of San Francisco, and he provided some financial financial via the private sector and academic support. He introduced me to Bill Richards, who's a remarkable clinical psychologist who resided right in Baltimore with me, and had worked extensively with Stan Grof and Walter Pahnke back in the 1960s and 70s, and had done quite a bit of clinical research on the classical hallucinogens. So we had his clinical expertise. And then we've had a number of other collaborators. Mary Casamano in our group is here. Mary, where are you? Someplace. Mary Casamano in our group's here. She's been very supportive. She's one of our clinical guides. So what I want to do is just start by telling you, going into a little bit of detail about our first study. What I'm going to do is tell you about our first study, the follow-up from that study. That was the first study was published in 2006. Then I'll tell you a little bit about a dose effect study that we've done in healthy volunteers. That's unpublished data. And about telling you about our cancer psilocybin trial being funded by the Hefter Group, and for which we're struggling with volunteers, getting volunteer referrals, and for which I'd like to solicit your help. But let me start by telling you a little bit about that first study. So the, you know, our goal initially was really quite modest. We just had the purpose of determining the safety and evaluating both the acute and persisting mood-altering and psychological effects of high dose of psilocybin relative to an active control compound. And the intention was to use double-blind pharmacology methods and an experimental design that would minimize the confounding effects of expectancy, because expectancy so often colors the results and the interpretation of results of studies of this kind. The participants in the study were recruited from the local community through flyers announcing the study of states of consciousness brought about by naturally occurring psychoactive substances used sacramentally. We studied 36 participants. Females were slightly overrepresented, about 56% were female. They're medically and psychiatrically healthy without histories of hallucinogen use. So that was a very interesting feature of this study, and one in which it was by no means certain that we could get approval for. When we initiated the whole asking for approval, I was guessing that the chances were, you know, probably less than 50%. We could thread all the needles that needed to be thread. But one of the keys that I really wanted to push for is being able to recruit in hallucinogen-naive volunteers. And we successfully did that, and I think it makes it a far more powerful study. And there are a couple reasons for that. One was it helped control for expectancy. Clearly, people with histories of exposure to classical hallucinogens would break through the blind instantaneously and know whether or not they received a hallucinogen. And then the other very important feature is selection bias. I think the assumption would be that you'd get a differential selection for recruiting among people who had had positive experiences. So if you really want to get some indication of what the rate of adverse events might be, hallucinogen-naive population might be better. And the volunteers, of course, they were not compensated. They did this on a volunteer basis. So the participants in the study were 36 people in all, mean age of 46 years. These were highly educated, most with college educations, I think more than 50% postgraduate degrees. Most were employed either full-time or part-time. This was really a high-functioning group of folks. We had physicians, psychologists, nurses, ministers, pastoral counselors, businessmen, consultants, an interesting, dynamic group of active people. One interesting feature of the population that we recruited had to do with their religious and spiritual activities. So 53%, more than half of them, indicated affiliation with a religious or spiritual community. And all of them indicated at least intermittent participation in religious or spiritual activities such as religious services, prayer, meditation, church choir, something of that sort. So there is this bias built into the study. Why did we do this? A couple reasons. One, of course, we were interested because of the historical indigenous use of mushrooms in sacramental settings. Two, we thought that it would reduce variability if we didn't include people who were widely divergent with respect to spiritual beliefs or understanding. And three, we thought, you know, that there might be a protective effect, that if in fact someone had a remarkably altered state of consciousness that they found difficult to integrate, they could at least relate this back to their spiritual community. They might have a vocabulary and a group to work with. And I seem to have a technical difficulty. There we go. Okay, the study design. The design compared 30 milligrams of psilocybin, which is a high dose of psilocybin, this is 30 milligrams per 70 kilograms, with methylphenidate hydrochloride. So methylphenidate is Ritalin. This is a high dose of Ritalin, using double-blind between-group crossover design that involved two or three eight-hour drug sessions conducted at two-month intervals. So the dose of psilocybin is a high dose of psilocybin. It's the same dose that Walter Pahnke gave in the Good Friday experiment. The literature suggested that it was about as high as we could feel comfortably going, and about as high as we could argue to the FDA that administration would be safe. In terms of the mushroom equivalent, Neil, I'm not sure I can answer that with any degree of accuracy. Of course, the amount of psilocybin in mushrooms varies markedly, tenfold across different batches. But I think that it would be safe to say it's about 12 grams of dried mushrooms. Methylphenidate dose, 40 milligrams per kilogram. That's a pretty high dose of methylphenidate, Ritalin. Why did we pick methylphenidate? Well, it's psychoactive. It has an onset and peak time that's roughly equivalent to psilocybin. It has some overlap in some of the profiles of subjective effects. So it's producing nervousness, excitability, increased positive mood. And the thought was that in hallucinogen-naive people, who incidentally had the instruction that they could receive a whole variety of different compounds and different doses of psilocybin, that methylphenidate might be mistaken for active compound. Let's see, so the whole variety of different doses of psilocybin both the guides and the volunteers were blinded to those possible outcomes. In fact, people received either or both psilocybin and methylphenidate in mixed order. There were meetings, of course, with the guides before and after the sessions. The primary guide met with each participant on several occasions for 8 clinical contact hours prior to the session, and for 4 hours after each session. Clearly, the purpose of this is to build rapport with the volunteer to make sure that that we can create a container of safety, at least with respect to that that relationship. The sessions themselves were conducted in our psychopharmacology laboratory, but a room unlike any of our other clinical laboratory rooms. It was doesn't show up very well here, but it's a living room-like environment with a couch and artwork on the walls. Participants came to the unit at 8 in the morning. They ingested psilocybin capsules orally. And as Dave said, Dave Nichols provided the psilocybin for us. 2 guides were present throughout sessions. So I don't think you can probably see this. We have a volunteer reclining on the couch, so the volunteer would come in. They'd be encouraged to recline on the couch, wear eye shades and headphones through which they listen to a pre-recorded program of classical music throughout the session. 2 guides were present. The volunteer was encouraged to turn his or her attention inward. And the guides were there really to provide this safe container and environment. If people became anxious, the guides would provide a reassuring touch to shoulder or to the arm, and encourage the person to go back in. So, in terms of results, let me start by just talking a little bit about the integrity of the blinding procedures. So a debriefing questionnaire indicated that the guides, in fact, were appropriately confused about the experimental design. So they thought that a range of doses of psilocybin had been administered, a range of other active compounds had been administered. 23% of the sessions were misclassified by guides. That is, they called methylphenidate session was identified as psilocybin, or psilocybin identified as something other than psilocybin. And interestingly, on 2 of 3 sessions on which psilocybin was misclassified, participants rated their experiences among the 5 most meaningful and spiritually significant experiences of their lives. So from that, we conclude that the experiences reported during the psilocybin sessions weren't really just artifacts of the guide's expectations. So this shows some within-session time course of some effects. This is a blood pressure and drug effect rating. The top set of data points are showing psilocybin time course curves. This is time. This is after administration here. And it's really just to show that they're kind of orderly time-related effects that we're seeing here. Psilocybin's producing greater blood pressure increases and greater ratings of overall drug effect, but the fill circles are showing significant points, and you can see the similarity in the methylphenidate time course with the psilocybin time course. And this is showing guides' ratings during the sessions. So the guides made a variety of ratings of behavioral state throughout the session. These are showing peak effects. So psilocybin here is showing greater stimulation than methylphenidate. Methylphenidate, there's more talking with the guide or the monitor during the session. Restlessness, fidgetiness, and sleepiness and sedation don't vary. But not surprisingly, volunteers showed a lot more emotionality during psilocybin session, as indicated by increased rates of tearing and crying, anxiety, fearfulness, joy, intense happiness, and peaceful harmony. Now, when you look at scales that really were developed to assess classical hallucinogen effects, such as this scale, the hallucinogen rating scale developed by Rick Straussman for his DMT work, you see that psilocybin produced classical hallucinogen-like effects. And so this is showing effects on intensity, somatesthesia, affect, perception, cognition, and volition. And it's really just reflecting that psilocybin's having its expected profile of effects. So perceptually, we're seeing visual pseudo-hallucinations, illusions, synesthesias, in terms of mood effects, periods of transcendence, sometimes periods of fear, grief, joy, and cognitive changes. There's an increased sense of meaning sometimes, or ideas of reference. So that's not so surprising. Now, what starts getting more interesting and resonant with the Good Friday findings are ratings such as this. This is the Pankey Richards Mystical Experience Questionnaire. This is a questionnaire that assesses the primary domains of mystical experience as has been described by people from the psychology of religion for well over 100 years, starting with William James and then codified and descriptively refined by Stace, and more recently by psychologists in the psychology of religion who have actually developed very nice questionnaires that I'll tell you about in a minute that are psychometrically solid and show cross-cultural generality and they're psychometrically robust. But the Pankey Richards questionnaire also taps these main features of mystical experience. And on this questionnaire, the criteria for meeting a priori, a full mystical experience, is that they have to show 60% or greater elevation on all the scales. And we had over 60% of our volunteers making that criteria. So what are these features of the primary mystical experience that define this experience? One is this sense of unity, this interconnectedness, the sense that all is one. And that, to my mind and from my reading of that literature, is probably the single most important feature of this experience. But the other features that come right along with it and really define the full-blown effect are a sense of sacredness. So embedded within this experience of unity is this sense of reverence or holiness, the intuitive knowledge, a sense of encountering ultimate reality. There's a truth value to this experience that is completely compelling, and it really accounts for the fact that well after the experience is done, people still believe that there's truth value in that experience, that there's a take-home lesson here. And so that's a very important feature of the experience. Transcendence of time and space. Time collapses, space collapses into the present moment. Deeply felt positivity, often experienced as open-heartedness or opening of the heart chakra, love, peace. And finally, this ineffability and paradoxicality feature. So one of the interesting things is the first thing that people end up describing after this experience when I would sit down and talk to them will tell me about the experience. The first thing they'd say is, you know, I can't possibly put this into words. And then they start doing it. And then paradoxicality seems to be the natural paradoxes are resolved. There's a complete fullness and a complete emptiness to the universe or to the void, for instance. This shows the results of another mysticism scale. This is the Hood mysticism scale. I'll go through this just quickly, just showing that. This is 2 months now after the first session, the group, the volunteers that got psilocybin on the first session are showing big elevations in this mysticism score. This is measuring lifetime mystical experience compared to methylphenidate. And then after the second session, they're both elevated because once it goes up, it's not going to come down. So that's one of those irreversible kinds of effects. So this is a scale that we actually developed after we had initiated the study when, partly to my chagrin, I thought we were missing some of the most interesting pieces. So volunteers were being interviewed now 2 months after sessions. Forget whether I mentioned these sessions were conducted at 2 month intervals, and this is showing how personally meaningful was the experience from a everyday experience up to the single most meaningful experience of my life. Interesting piece is that 70% of people are saying it's in the top five most meaningful experiences of their lives. How spiritually significant was the experience 2 months afterwards? 30% of these people who are already spiritually oriented are saying this is the single most spiritually significant experience of their life. A change in personal well-being and life satisfaction, we have about 80% of people making claims at 2 months that their life satisfaction has increased moderately or very much. And importantly, no one saying that life satisfaction has been decreased by these experiences. This shows a scale that assesses a whole variety of different changes of positive attitudes, moods, altruistic social effects, and positive behavioral changes. And these are all elevated by psilocybin compared to methylphenidate. So these are interesting. So people are making claims, this is 2 months after the experience, of attitudinal changes like having more personal integration, more meaning, more enthusiasm, patience, optimism, authenticity, self-confidence. Increased positive altruistic effects would be claims such as more sensitive, more compassionate, tolerant, increased positive relationship, greater need for service for others, increased social concern. The obvious question is this delusional? Is there any truth value to this? It turns out that there is. We did community observer ratings, so we independently did telephone ratings with friends, family members, and co-workers, and we see the same general positive relationship here that's significant. all was not love and light. There's significant fear and anxiety that came up for some volunteers. About 31% of the volunteers after psilocybin, none after methylphenidate, reported strong or extreme ratings of fear sometime during the session. 11% reported their entire session was dominated by fear and anxiety. An important comment would be that despite these psychological struggles, no one indicated that that they had been harmed by this experience. So although these were very, very difficult experiences, they apparently were not harmful experiences. This shows 14-month follow-up data showing, in effect, that these effects are sustained 14 months. I'm now going to just turn briefly, tell you a little bit about a dose effect study that we've done. So that was our first study. We subsequently have done a study looking at dose effects with psilocybin. We looked at 0, 5, 10, 20, and 30 milligrams per 70 kilograms. Sessions were conducted at 1 month intervals. I'm going to just skip over some of the demographic stuffs that are very similar across the two studies. We have beautiful dose effect curves, so nice dose and time related effects with these doses of psilocybin. And essentially, we're seeing a good systematic replication of the effects. They're dose-dependent effects. I think that one of the things that's of most interest to us is that the 5-milligram dose of psilocybin is really quite active. So we might not have expected as much. The fear and anxiety is really still there. We have 39% of people reporting fear or anxiety, extreme fear or anxiety, at least sometime during the session. Again, elevations in the mystical experience questionnaires. About 60% of people showing complete mystical experiences at the high dose. And again, at 1 month follow-up, these effects are sustained, and we're getting dose-related effects. So we're getting dose-related increases in ranking of these experiences as being most meaningful and spiritually significant. So the conclusions for the healthy normal studies are these: that with careful subject preparation and when sessions are conducted under comfortable, well-supervised conditions, psilocybin can be administered safely. Despite extensive preparation and screening, 6 to 11% had significant fear, anxiety, dysphoria throughout the session, which is, there's an interesting cautionary note about that. In spite of all our preparation, we can't rule out that. Under the conditions of the study, these psilocybin does occasion experiences having marked similarities to classically occurring mystical experiences. And in that sense, it's a nice replication, systematic replication and extension of the Good Friday experiment with a number of new and additional positive features. Let me now just say in the last minute, if Neil will let me, that we're conducting now a study in cancer patients. So we're doing a study of psilocybin effects in cancer patients. We're actively trying to recruit 44 cancer patients to participate in the study. The, you know, basic hypothesis here is, and these are people who have anxiety or depression secondary to a cancer diagnosis. The basic hypothesis here is, does a mystical experience occasioned by psilocybin have a clinically meaningful effect in this population? There's reason to believe that it should, based on older research from the 50s and 60s and unpublished preliminary work that Charlie Grobe has reported. The study itself involves two psilocybin sessions separated by about a month in a six-month follow-up assessment. Enrollment is open nationally, and the first three volunteers have resided out of state, although our budget doesn't allow for us to pay for travel. And here's really one of the things that really motivated to have me come up here today is that we really need your help in recruiting volunteers for this study. Recruitment has been frustratingly slow. We grossly underestimated the conservative attitude of the oncology community to provide referrals into this protocol. The inclusion criteria, 21 to 70 years old, cancer diagnosis that's potentially life-threatening, patients with and without disease progression are eligible, so it's not necessary to be restricted to an end-stage disease. Those without disease progression are eligible if at least a year has lapsed since their initial diagnosis. So we don't want to enroll someone who has an acute diagnosis, they've had a lumpectomy, they're still anxious, but that's going to resolve naturalistically over the course of the next 6 months. But if they make it past a year and they still have clinical discomfort, then we'd like to evaluate them. And the cancer needs to be without CNS or brain involvement. We have a website, www.cancer-insight.org. So if you go to that website or an interested volunteer goes to the website, they can get all the information. They can look at some background videos from Charlie Grobe's study. We have flyers in the back of the room. Mary Casamano's in the back of the room. So if you know of anyone who might be eligible, or if you know of oncologists who would be inclined to refer volunteers, please let them know of our study. Thank you very much. We have a lot of interest in it, and we have no money to do any of the interesting things that we want to do. So right now, another plea I would make is that right now all of our funding is coming from Hefter and other non-federal sources. We'd love to do the basic pharmacology and comparative pharmacology of these drugs and simply don't have the resources to do it. And it needs to be done. I mean, this is just, it's way too interesting and important not to do. Yeah. Yes, and either volunteers were... the question was, did volunteers after participation subsequently go out and seek mushrooms? And the answer is no. To our knowledge, they did not. You need to understand the context in which this occurred. These are people who came into this project interested in their own spiritual development, and I think they felt by the end of the study that they were engaged in an important endeavor with us, and I think many of them recognize that going out and doing something of that sort might put this whole thing at risk. That would be one of my interpretations. Yeah, that's a really interesting extension. So right now, no. I've actually seen, so the question is there any plans to study the effects of psilocybin on the anxiety of the caretakers within the cancer community? And it's a very interesting question. I've seen one protocol from another research center that actually intends to target that outcome as along with the patients, but not to administer the psilocybin to the caretaker. But there are many, many applications of that sort, and really any severe disease process in which people are confronting existential issues, you know, of death and loss of loved one might be very interesting applications for this kind of approach. So were there any other medical precautions that we are required to take? Were there docs on hands and so forth? Absolutely. So just getting this protocol approved through our medical center was a challenge. Johns Hopkins is a conservative medical establishment, so we have a whole variety of contingency plans in effect. We never had to use them. We never had to use an escape medication, but they were there. Physicians were on immediate call to the protocol, and we had no untoward effects, which was really lovely. That was really a reflection of Bill Richards. He was our clinical guide. So how did we decide what artwork would go on the walls, and what about the musical selection? And Bill Richards, our clinical guide, made the selection of artwork with some input from us. There was eclectic artwork, Christian, Buddhist, and other religious traditions, Native American artwork. The music was entirely classical for the first study. Our subsequent study, we've thrown in some Eastern music. We made the decision not to allow the volunteer control over the musical program. We wanted them to surrender to the situation. And we recognize those are arbitrary decisions at best, and a rich avenue for future research. Last question. So have any of the volunteers reported memories of birth or past lives, did you say? Anything? Let's see. So, I mean, the imagery that comes out of these sessions is rich. People report all kinds of things. We have not had the psychological framework from which our major clinical guide works has not imposed or held tightly to psychological frame such as Groff's birth staging, but some people certainly had experiences that would fit under those kinds of classifications. But thematically, I would be hesitant to say that we had anything that that came out as very loudly in terms of, or consistently in terms of birth phenomenology, for instance, or past life, or anything of that sort. I think the mystical experience questionnaire really captures, you know, the robustness of what occurs and the generality of that, and the specific phenomenology is appears quite idiosyncratic.
Thank you very much, Roland.